The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Best host for the hour, in fact. It's Barry Ritholtz. He is from Fusion IQ. He is the big picture blog extraordinaire. And so, Dollar General, okay? I could put a positive question on this. I could say, wow, wouldn't it be great if Dollar General weren't doing as well because people were not being, were feeling like, I don't have to buy stuff at Dollar General. I can trade up to Target or something.
Well, the phrase we use to describe that is called retail slumming. When you work your way from Macy's to JCPenney's to Target to Walmart to Dollar General. And it's oftentimes a sign of broad economic stress. You know, 20 years ago, the data that would come out of firms like that was really insightful. But what we're seeing in this current post-credit crisis recovery is very much a two-track recovery. If you look at the unemployment rate for people with college degrees or advanced degrees, really low, low single digits. If you look at people who work in certain areas that can take advantage of low interest rates, that can take advantage. So look at the commercial real estate, look at what's going on in auto sales, look at what's going on in a lot of the financial universe. Things are actually looking pretty good. If you look in the heartland outside of energy, things aren't looking as nearly as good. And so the Walmart has this metric where they want to track how often people who are getting paid every other week are spending their money. They can actually check their flows and say people are cashing their checks and running to Walmart to buy food and diapers and the like. That's never a positive, at least for that segment of the economy. And the argument that a lot of people have made, and I believe, is when the bottom third of the country is doing really poorly, it doesn't bode well for a broad economic expansion. Now, that can change over the next couple of years. The results of what the Fed has been doing doesn't really find its way to the lower classes very quickly. It's a long,
slow. You could call
crisis.
It a trickle-down monetary policy. It helps people who own stocks. It helps people with great credit scores, great FICO scores, so they can refi a bazillion times and take advantage of the low mortgage rates. But the people at the bottom who need it the most often aren't.
The price of auto leases, all right? Now, again, your audience, I would bet a healthy chunk of people are going to go out and lease a BMW or a Jaguar or an Infiniti or some other high-end car. The cost of finance within the monthly leases have shrunk to such low levels that $60,000 cars that used to cost $900 a month to lease are now close to six and change. It's an astonishing – I'm a car guy, so I'm always checking prices. And some of the costs have come down, and you look at them, and that can't – it's got to be $10,000 down. And it's really quite astonishing.
Are we moving into a world, Barry, that's so sort of stratified, not just in the United States, but, you know, Asia too, that's what investors should be betting on now? Demographic trends, and, you know, you go along the middle class and short the lower classes, or I mean, is that what we are going to be seeing soon?
There's certainly an element of that. What ends up happening is the middle class has getting pushed closer to the lower classes, and you used to count on the middle class as a major driver of economic activity, of retail spending, energy, homes, automobiles, et cetera. And as we go through this deleveraging process, here we are 4 years, 5 years past the crash, there's still a lot of debt. There's still a lot of deleveraging yet to come. Everybody has been critical of Reinhardt and Rogoff's debt to GDP paper, but their previous paper, when you look at what a traditional credit crisis recovery looks like, they were dead on. The first draft of that was out in, I believe, January 2008 or December 2007.
That was the thesis.
The premise for the book was a paper they did that came out before Bear Stearns even crashed and burned. So that's how astute they were in terms of looking at that data. The later paper, well, perhaps not as much, but hey, you know, any sequel is never as good as the first, with very few exceptions.
So the stock market broadly bullish? bearish
well,
in between?
We're pretty fully invested. We have been for 4 years or so, and what we've been saying is eventually this market will roll over, but so far the signs aren't there. We continue to give the market the benefit of the doubt. Here's the thing to think of. We're not even, you know, it's the third month of the second quarter. Markets are up 15% year to date. Hey, that's a great year, and we're not even halfway through it. So I have to think that a little backing and filling, a little digestion, certainly wouldn't surprise me to see a soft couple of months or even a quarter or two before we get to the end of the year. You can't run at that rate indefinitely.
We're just getting started. Speaking of running at this rate, Barry Ritholtz, Fusion IQ, the Big Picture blog, and we're bringing in some special guests, some very interesting topics as we continue here, the Hays Advantage on Bloomberg Radio.
The Market Drivers Report on the Hays Advantage is brought to you by the Mercedes-Benz Summer Event. Visit your Mercedes-Benz Tri-State dealers for limited-time lease and financing offers on select Mercedes-Benz models. On the web at searchmercedes.com, but hurry because just like summer, these offers won't last. Throughout Asia. We've been speaking and continue to speak with Barry Ritholtz, Fusion IQ, the Big Picture blog. He's our guest host for the hour, and we'll also be speaking now with Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter at ProPublica. He covers Wall Street and wrote a great piece on why fund managers may be right about the Fed most recently. Welcome, Jesse. You're joining us on the Ring Central phone line.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me.
Is this just sour grapes on the part of fund managers because it's more difficult to figure out returns in this environment?
Yes, but this doesn't mean that they're wrong. You know, it's much harder for them to make money. They're middlemen, and the Fed is narrowing the bid and the ask between assets. This makes it a lot harder for them to reach fees. Of course, they're asset managers, asset owners as well as managers, so they're benefiting from all the asset inflation that we have, but it makes it harder for them to stand back. But the real issue here, what they're getting at, is whether there's some kind of overvaluation in the markets going on, and I'm increasingly convinced there is.
Jesse, it's Barry Ritholtz. How are you doing
hey,
this
Barry.
Morning?
Good.
How much of what we're seeing from hedge fund managers is a little bit of think tank wannabes and essentially forecasts couched in the terminology of Fed criticism?
Well, yeah. So these guys are dabbling out of their area of expertise mostly in macroeconomics, and they don't know what they're talking about. So they've been forecasting inflation, but there are good reasons to think that there is no inflation, there won't be any inflation, or they've been forecasting a crash in the dollar. So we've heard all of that.
Right, forecasting hyperinflation as well. Forget just regular inflation.
Right, exactly. You know, you hear the Zimbabwe talk every time you swing a dead cat and hit a hedge fund manager. But when they're talking about the market, that's when my ears perk up, because I really think that they do understand the market. So they're getting at some sensibility that I trust the Fed economists rough on. So when you see froth in collateralized loan obligations and junk bonds and Phoenix housing and high beta stocks, that gets my ears perking up and gets me worried.
So where is this taking us, Jesse? What's the implication?
The implication to me is that we are moving from the bust to the bubble, and we just forgot to have the economic recovery in between. And I'm worried about that. It's not clear to me that that's happening, but I really see that we obviously don't have a sustainable economic recovery now that's creating real jobs and real wage growth. That's the important thing. Instead, what we're creating is an enormous amount of wealth for the 1%, while we are an increasing credit cycle means that we're furthering the debt of the middle class and lower class, and so that doesn't seem to be a workable solution to get to an economic recovery.
Okay, Jesse Eisinger, thanks for joining us. Busy morning for you. Thanks for picking up the phone and joining us here on the Hays Advantage on the Ring Central phone line. Senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street. So, you know, Barry, you are a big fan of Jesse's work. What is so important about the argument he made in that recent piece? What is it that you want listeners and readers to take away from this?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, I've become more and more enamored of behavioral economics and looking at, you know, maybe it's the background of having gone to law school instead of business school. I look at everybody as a witness on the stand and not necessarily as just an expert. And if they're a witness, I want to know what are their biases, what are their motivations. Hey, what do they stand to gain from the argument they're making? And so when I see a lot of hedge funds, especially the past 1, 3, and 5 years, the piece Dave Wilson did the other day showed how much hedge funds have underperformed since the market lows of March 09. They've done terribly. They've averaged 3 or 4%. The markets are averaging 11%, and that's before we start taking in fees. So I can't help but wonder if a lot of the underperformance is either risk aversion or the criticism of the Fed is, as I think you mentioned, called it sour grapes. But that's just the first part of it. The second part of it is we are really in uncharted waters. We've never had a central bank do what this bank is doing with a nation this size and an economy this large.
But bottom line, they're supporting risk. The central bank in the U.S. is supportive of risk. So why is risk becoming a dirty word?
I wouldn't say that that's the case necessarily. I wouldn't say that they're supporting risk. I think that once the Fed let's back up a moment. The whole ZERP and QE and zero interest rate policy didn't come about in a vacuum. It came about because we had a massive financial collapse that was followed by a massive bailout of the banks. Instead of allowing the banks to do what happens when any company goes bankrupt, see that building over there with the pretty columns? That's a bankruptcy court. Walk over there, fire the senior management, wipe out the shareholders, and whatever's left, clean up, and you give it to the share to the bondholders. And if you want to spin it out as a clean, right, debt-free entity, you can. That's an option. But saying, "Oh, we screwed up," can the taxpayers write a $500 billion check or an $800 billion check? Is what tied the Fed's hands. So now you have all these banks; they're on life support. They barely survive a really easy stress test. Their books are festooned with bad loans, which courtesy of the FASB rule change, the accounting rule change, they don't have to report.
So how does QE—
So the Fed has to keep the rates low to prevent more foreclosures.
Yeah, but keeping the rates low is one thing. Continuing to buy bonds and easing every month. The Fed gets easier every month,
right?
Okay?
As more liquidity purchases, more stimulus, drives rates down. Yep.
How does that keep the banks afloat, quote unquote? And what about the argument? You can never prove this one way or another. People who said the unemployment stayed high, QE didn't work, they may be right.
What's the counterfactual? If we didn't have QE, we were talking about cars before.
You should do even more. You should double down on QE, but we'll never be able to prove it.
But remember, monetary policy has very specific results. What you're really referring to is fiscal policy. So we have an AWOL Congress, the playbook that every administration for the past 100 years has done is when there's a deep recession, you deficit spend, you do infrastructure projects, you do stimulus. Doesn't matter, Republican or Democrat, the other side criticizes it, the side in power does it.
Okay, Barry Ritholtz in studio, guest host, Hayes Advantage, Bloomberg Radio. Up next, we'll be joined as well by Daniel Gross from Daily Beast.
And keeping an eye on the markets on the Hayes Advantage, we are seeing stocks just come off their highs now. The S&P 500 up half a point, 1641. The Dow up just 3 points, unchanged at 15,257.
Kathleen Hayes, we're going to get to Dan Gross in just a minute from Newsweek and the Daily Beast to talk about the economy and what it all means for the markets and the Fed, et cetera. Yeah, the basketball game last night, I just couldn't watch by the end. Now, granted, I'm a contrarian. I go for underdogs. I think two great teams. But, oh, my God, the Pacers came out of Game 6 looking like they could take it to the Heat again. And, oh, what happened?
Well, first, LeBron James stepped up big time when it counted and got support by his supporting players.
Dwayne Wade was so criticized.
Pretty much disappeared from other than one game the rest of the series. But I have to tell you, first of all, I think the Heat is sort of like that Chicago Bulls team of the 90s when you had Michael Jordan and they were – the top of the heap. This is a team that potentially can be that sort of dynasty. But when you see the Indiana Pacers
playing like a team, Barry.
Very, very impressive.
They rebound. They pass the ball. Come on.
That's right. Well, you know, the thing I love about LeBron, big man who thinks pass first. I mean, what did he have, 15 or 16 assists last night?
He was on fire.
He can do that like Michael Jordan. He could do that anytime. He's always a threat. As long as and this, by the way, was the problem that Jordan had. We could talk about basketball for hours. This was the problem when it was Michael Jordan, superstar, no one around him. The defense collapses on him. As long as someone else is a threat around the perimeter and he's willing to dump it out, he becomes unguardable, and LeBron is the same way.
Okay, 11:45, we're going to talk about the playoffs, okay? So hold all those thoughts. Now, let's get to Dan Gross, patiently waiting on the line, Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Dan, welcome. Hello, Dan.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yep. Sure can. Hear you loud and clear. Your view of the economy. Barry said, let's talk to Dan, because you know what? He can explain why we're all worried about the economy, doom and gloom, but it's not all that bad. There are pockets of positivity.
Yeah, I'm always sort of amazed by what I think is, I don't want to say it's systematic, but definitely there's a kind of groupthink where we focus on the Fed, we focus on Wall Street, we focus on the incorrigible banks, we focus on dysfunctional politics, and you know, for a lot of us, that's our whole world. But there's this is a very big country, and there's a lot of other stuff going on. I always tweet, today we got the trade deficit figures. And I always put out a tweet said, you know, the U.S. doesn't make anything the world wants except for the $187 billion of stuff we exported in April. Even with this global slowdown, exports are up year over year. They're up through the first 4 months of the year. By the way, our imports are declining, including $25 billion less we've spent this year on foreign oil. And so when you look at some of these trends, we export a lot more. Our auto industry, which is both our biggest manufacturing industry and our biggest retail sector, is doing really well, increasing production, increasing sales, selling more efficient cars so that people
don't
have to spend so much
on oil. Yeah, but then, Dan, we're not seeing enough demand to put people back
to
work all the same.
I'm sorry?
We're still not seeing enough demand to pull people back to work all the same.
That is our consistent problem. And, you know, the problem we have now is that the economy is sort of like a plane, and you've got one engine, the Fed, which is kind of going in a high gear, and even if it goes in a slightly high gear, it's not going to make it go any faster. And we're seeing this big drag from the fiscal side, not just the federal government, which is shrinking spending and has raised some taxes, but state and local, which, you know, even though their finances are recovering and they're starting to have surpluses, are still cutting jobs. They employ, state and local governments employ 700,000 fewer people than they did in 2009. That usually does not happen. And, you know, my big thing, the thing I've been banging the drum is that, you know, people keep looking for some sort of big deal from Congress and the White House, and we'll get more stimulus and construction spending. That's not going to happen. The next stimulus, if there is to be one, is going to have to come from companies who I think would be well advised to use some of their surplus cash, and rather than buy back shares or pay big dividends to people who already have a ton of money, just give their workers a little bit of a raise. Not much, but a little bit, because they haven't been doing that. And the biggest problem for domestic companies is the lack of domestic demand.
It becomes a self-reinforcing cycle where wages are held down, and gee, what a surprise, people aren't out shopping. You know, we put a chart up on the blog a couple of weeks ago that showed the relative hiring from state and local governments as well as the federal government following the recession in 08 and following the recession in 01, and they're totally opposite charts. In 01 forward, there was a ton of state and local and federal hiring. And it's been the exact opposite following the 08 recession, 09 recession, where government is actually a drag on the economy, laying people off as opposed to adding headcount. What do you think about that, Dan?
I think, A, it's exactly right. B, some of it is politically motivated. You have a fair number of Republican governors who have come in and said, you know, we want to stick it to the unions, we want to have fewer employees, et cetera, make them less powerful. But you've also had, you know, these states have had very large and persistent budget deficits because their revenues have not come back, and they are not allowed to run deficits. So what do? The easiest way to cut spending frequently is to fire people.
Okay, Dan Gross, keep that thought going. We're going to come right back to Dan Gross, Newsweek and Daily Beast, Barry Ritholtz in studio. We're going to look more at the economy, what it means for the markets and investors on Bloomberg Radio.
Barry Ritholtz, Fusion IQ, and also the Big Picture blog has been with us in studio. He is staying out the hour with us as guest host, and we're also lucky to be joined by Daniel Gross, columnist and global business editor at Newsweek and also the Daily Beast. And we've been speaking with Dan about the economy. And Dan, what about the Federal Reserve then and tapering? Does it even matter if investors are looking for return whether the Federal Reserve does taper this year or not?
Well, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, the Blue Oyster Cult had a song that said, "Don't Fear the Reaper." It was from the 70s, and I think there's something sort of similar, "Don't Fear the Taper." You know, we don't have much evidence. I think this notion that they're suddenly going to stop buying entirely on a date certain is, you know, that's not what's going to happen. And when you look at the economy, you know, the amount of increased economic activity, $16 trillion economy that's growing between 2 and 3% a year, it's several hundred billion dollars, you know, $40 or $50 billion in new economic activity a month. You look at wages. There is money coming into this economy that is not the Fed creating new cash, which was really not the case in 2008 and 2009. And if companies actually were to pay a little more, it would sort of outweigh some of these tapering effects. In addition, I think, you know, Barry's noted this, and I think anyone who covers the markets has noted this. The Fed purchasing these mortgage-backed securities, I mean, it trickles down to a certain degree, but the refinancing boom is really over. Probably was over at the end of last year. Many people who don't have great credit or equity in their house were not unable to benefit from it. And so, you know, it was very much geared, you know, companies. The problem for companies is not that they were unable to borrow at very low rates. I mean, corporations have been borrowing at extremely low rates for several years now, and they have not been translating those lower borrowing costs into better wages. So I think the Fed is doing this QE because that's what it can do, and that's the tools it has at its disposal. And because the others in this economy who could and should be doing stuff that will stimulate it aren't doing their job. So I think the impact of QE3 has been overestimated, especially on what I would call the real economy. And as a result, the impact of the tapering is likely to be overestimated as well.
Yeah, Dan, I keep hearing from people that what happens when the Fed starts to sell? And my answer has always been, well, they don't have to sell. They could just run this out. Let the duration do its thing. You don't have to roll it over. You don't have to buy more bonds, but you could just hold it until maturity, and that's the end of that story. And their balance sheet will magically become healthy. That's the beauty of owning bonds. You have a date certain when it's no longer a liability.
Barry, how are they going to determine bonuses if they don't mark to market every day? And, of course, the beauty of this, and again, this also a little understood, the Federal Reserve turns over its profits
to the Treasury. Yep.
And it's been doing so. You know, the more assets it has, the more interest payments it collects. And, of course, there's something circular to this because the Treasury bonds, the interest on those comes from the taxpayers. The mortgage-backed interest payments are, for a while, they were coming from the taxpayers. Now that Fannie and Freddie are actually making money, it's sort of guaranteed by the taxpayers. But that money is funneled back into the Treasury at a rate of, I believe, you know, sort of $60 or $70 billion a year.
Yeah.
It's a material addition to what's going on. So as long as they sit there and collect interest payments, it's hard to see what the downside is.
Well, I want to ask another type of question because we have heard from people talking about the housing market, the mortgage market. I can't believe that just this small move up off of ultra-low 30-year fixed mortgage rates is going to make that much difference to housing. But I'm hearing that, no, there are buyers who are going to be priced out very quickly. If housing has been part of the recovery, if housing's been helping to push things ahead, is that one of the risks? Especially when the mortgage market is so nervous about this Fed wanting to get rid of the mortgage-backed securities it owns much more than the treasuries it owns.
So you have two things going on, and I'd love to hear from Dan about both. One is the massive amount of private equity money, and by some estimates, it's $25 to $30 billion, buying homes in a sort of rent-to-flip basis. It was a front-page story in the Times, but we've been talking about this for a year. And the other factor is just the number of people who have no equity or low equity or negative equity, and so they're not buyers or sellers, and that's part of the reason why there's no inventory on the market. Dan, if you can address either of those.
Yeah, first, you know, let's say interest rates were to spike. I think it would actually, the first people it would take out would be these guys who are raising pools of capital and buying hundreds and thousands of houses. And by the way, that's going to end very poorly. The Blackstone Group is, you know, the notion of the Blackstone Group being like a landlord to tens of thousands of people in homes, it's very hard to see how this ends well, because they have to sell it to some other chump, and you know that's probably going to be the public. And if they're wise, they won't buy it.
Dan, by the way, every time we've seen any venture capital, private equity find a new space, be it dot-coms or timber or what have you, the first guys in make money, the copycats come in, and if they're lucky, they break even, and then everybody else
yep.
gets mangled. You talked about this in your book, Pop, Why Bubbles Are Sometimes Good for the Economy.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think part of the thing, many people are saying that the price increases we've seen in housing, 10% year over year, is unsustainable, unwarranted. If you took a lot of these mass buyers out, maybe, you know, if prices were increasing 2 or 3 or 4% a year, even off this lower base, that would probably be more healthy. You hear people saying, you know, how can I compete as someone who has to go out and actually get a mortgage and apply and be approved? How can I compete with a guy who's showing up with wads of cash? Maybe that would make for a somewhat more rational market. And as far as economic housing is contributing to the economic recovery, you know, there are a few channels through which that works. There's existing home sales, which every time a house is sold, it generates a commission and, you know, insurance and a mover and all the stuff that that calls into play. A second, I would say, almost as powerful one is the new construction of housing. And what we've seen is inventory is very low, in part because a lot of people are still underwater and they can't sell, in part because there was no housing built here for a few years. And, you know, people are forming households. We have immigration. They're getting married. They're having kids. They got to live somewhere. And I think we're still seeing, if memory serves, I think housing starts are up 15-20% year over year. And I'm not saying we have a shortage of housing in this country, but it certainly seems like there, in some areas, there is a shortage of homes for sale. Some of that will be remedied by new construction, and you know that's to the good.
Dan Gross, thanks for joining us. Appreciate
Anytime.
The positive thoughts from Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Barry Ritholtz, okay, final thoughts. You want final thoughts on the markets
sure.
or final thoughts on the NBA playoffs? Or both?
Well, the NBA playoffs we can talk about forever. I'm looking forward to the finals. But let's talk a little bit about the markets. It's funny, screaming up 20% since the end of November, up 16% with dividends reinvested year to date. And the market has a one-day stumble. You know, even with the sell-off from the highs, May, we were still up 2.1% for the month. So before everybody panics, hey, you're up 16% for the year. If you think that's sustainable, if you think we're going to continue that torrid pace, especially when you see what – look at Japan. 12 months, the market practically doubled, 8,300 to 16,000. Of course they have to slow 15%. Down. Of course they have to sell.
Give us a quick summary of your paper, Barry, Romancing Alpha, Forsaking Beta. Is this the new?
Well, we've been looking at private equity and hedge funds and looking at their returns as an industry as well as specific hedge funds. And it seems that, and Dave Wilson talked about this a few days ago, it seems that the mad dash for outperformance has led to massive underperformance, and that's before we roll in very, very high fees. And to the various pension fund managers and public trustees who have an outsized amount of exposure to this asset class. Remember, hedge funds are just about $2 trillion. They're barely 1.1% of total assets. We keep seeing public pension funds with 15, 20, 25%. They're paying up for it, but you know, come for the high fees, stay for the underperformance is really not in the best interest of their charges.
Barry Ritholtz, come back soon. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.